You're listening to Panel Borders. I'm Alex Fitch, and this is an extract from Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. In this episode, I'm talking to writer Ian Edgington and artist Matt Brooker, who goes by the pen name Disraeli, about their work in sci-fi, from Matt's early experiences on the cyberpunk strip Lazarus Churchyard, and Ian's work on the comics based on the 20th Century Fox franchises Alien, Predator, and the inevitable Aliens vs. Predator, as well as their collaborations on Scarlet Traces, Kingdom of the Wicked, and Stickleback. First of the pair to speak is Ian. The pair of you have collaborated on quite a few comics now. The War of the Worlds Scarlet Traces trilogy, Leviathan, Kingdom of the Wicked. What started the working relationship?
Back in the days of yore, we got approached by a small press independent comic called Blam. It was like an A3, I think it was giveaway, run by Don Melia and Lionel Gracie Whitman. And they were like pairing like unknown comic talent at the time, kind of thing.
And these two guys were instrumental in getting the sort of late 80s self-publishing movement going. So they self-published a comic called Heartbreak Hotel, which was kind of music-based comic where they got a lot of people to contribute, a lot of professionals and people who would later become very well-established professionals. But also they got Alan Moore interested in self-publishing and setting up his
Mad Love publications.
And also they were instrumental in inspiring Brett Ewins and Steve Dillon to start Deadline magazine as well. And so they did this thing, Blam, as a free sheet, and they actually put the two of us together on a little kind of four-page, really kind of like sort of inconsequential little thing. But it was just a piece of fun, basically, kind of four pages. About this guy who discovers a tin of sort of raw life stuff floating in space and takes it back to God, who lives in Manchester. It's a very odd kind of story, but wonderful.
So there's stuff going further back that people who might have seen the hardbacks of your work aren't aware of, that perhaps could be collected at a future date.
Well, in fact, that particular one is in the back of the Kingdom of the Wicked album, because what we did was we did this little story, God's Little Acre, and then a couple of years later we were paired up, because we'd already worked together, we were paired up by a company called Tundra to do Kingdom of the Wicked, which is a much longer project. And when the Kingdom of the Wicked reprint came about, because it was already so large, we managed to fit in the God's Little Acre strip as a little extra in the back. So the Kingdom of the Wicked hardback reprint is a kind of little compendium of our early work in itself.
So we thought, in essence, everything we've done together is in print. Which is quite fortunate.
When Scarlet Traces started, it was on a website called Cool Beans. And people are talking about web comics now as being like, you know, a way of delivering the format. But it seemed that Cool Beans was almost too good and too early. I mean,
yeah, it was definitely an idea ahead of its time. I mean, it was the whole kind of notion they had of what they wanted to deliver and how they wanted to deliver it, which was comics enhanced using Flash with limited amounts of animation on them and stuff like that. Essentially, it required broadband. And at the time they were doing this, which was like 2000 onwards, Cool Beans folded in 2002, there was really just not enough broadband penetration in the country to support them. They were apparently getting a lot of hits in both Scandinavia and California, which had very high broadband penetration at that time. But, I mean, for example, I got a free pass because I was a creator. And on, 96K dial-up, I could never actually get the site to run because it was just so sort of heavy that I couldn't manage the downloads. So I never actually saw my own strip on my own broadband connection. I never saw simulations of it at the Cool Beans offices. It really was. It's like, now if they did it, it might possibly work. But as you say, it was just an idea, unfortunately, that was way ahead of its time. Luckily, when we did Scarlet Traces, we always had in mind that we should leave open the door to do a print version, although we had no idea at that point how that would be achieved. Mm. Because at that point I was drawing on computer, I made sure to do all the digital originals at very high resolution so they would be suitable for print. And also we designed the pages so that they would be what they call landscape, wider than they are tall, which meant they would fit very nicely on a monitor. But they were also proportioned so that if a print version ever came about, you could stack them one above the other and make a portrait format tall print page out of them, which is what we eventually did.
And then subsequently it was reprinted in Judge Dredd magazine and then by Dark Horse. So obviously it had fans out there.
Yeah, this was actually quite a clever piece of chicanery on Ian's part. When Cool Beans folded, we didn't actually have a complete project. It was something like, 75% finished? Basically, what ended up being Chapter 4, we'd only got a few pages of it. And Ian managed to get the rights for the stuff back from Cool Beans. And then we struck a deal with the magazine to treat it as a reprint. Now, at the time, the magazine, which was a companion to 2000 AD, a monthly magazine, to keep costs down, about between a third and a quarter of each issue would be reprint. But the problem with that, from their point of view, is that a certain number of the fans would always have seen the reprint material, and so it was never a popular strategy for them. And what we offered them, therefore, was to do a reprint of a strip that had never been printed, which nobody had seen. So they effectively got new material for a reprint fee. Under the reprint arrangement, we kept all the rights, and we got just enough money to allow us to finish the strip. Now, if we'd done that as original commissioned work for them, we'd have got a lot more money per page, but they would have kept everything. As it was, we used that reprint fee to finish the strip, and with a complete property in hand, we could then look around, and Dark Horse was then willing to take the complete property because it hadn't been seen in the US, and it was very cheap for them to publish because it was already complete, and it all existed as digital files, so the printing costs were relatively low.
The existing digital files actually worked in our favour with Cool Beans because when they went bust and the receivers locked the door, there was actually, you know, there was no physical artwork inside. You know, Matt had everything on file, so basically we still owned everything, and it was just a matter of kind of like negotiation with them to say, let us have the rights back, because, you know, they couldn't do anything else with it, and it was, you know, so I did a bit of haggling, and then when we actually came to do it in the magazine as well, I think because of the page size. The magazine at the time was a very a taller format than it is now, so we did these kind of toppers with a lion and a unicorn kind of emblem on the top, with a little comment on each one, like Boys Own Adventure magazines, you know, turn of the century. So it was, you know, like I know Robert Orton pulled it off, or with a bound he was free. So, but when we actually did the hardback for Dark Horse, there wasn't any room for that. So that version in the magazine that's original in its own way.
And we did also, when the Dark Horse reprint came about, we were given more pages. So although the script wasn't rewritten, in consultation with Ian, we went through and in the final chapter, we redistributed the story over more pages to give the pages kind of more room to breathe and make the panel count match what had happened earlier. Because in the magazine version, the last few pages are very crushed together, lots of panels on them. And so effectively I ended up redrawing the last chapter twice because of there was actually very little that I had to completely redraw, because luckily with working digitally I could take the I'm working in a program called Adobe Illustrator where you can enlarge or reduce images without degrading them. What it allowed me to do was to take certain panels and blow them right up or reduce them right down and change the proportions of them, maybe drawing the odd little extra bit where the proportions needed to change. And so there was probably something like 3 or 4 weeks' work in actually converting one reprint format to another reprint format. And so it remains this project which has been reprinted about 3 times, but it's possibly never actually had an original printing. It's a very strange artifact. And also, because it's digital, if you own a copy of the book, you actually own the original, because it doesn't exist. You know, the only form of it where it exists on paper is a printed copy that you know you can buy in the shop. So that's kind of side of it that I rather like, that everybody owns an original of Scarlet Traces.
In terms of the subject matter, a mixture of steampunk and sci-fi and horror, it would seem to be a dream project for you, Ian, based on other things that you've done over the years.
Yeah, it appeals to my nature, kind of. And it was one of the first kind of science fiction ideas I had back when I was a boy. The first science fiction novels I read were Day of the Triffids, War of the Worlds, and it always struck me whatever happened to the Martian technology. I'd always assumed as well that the invasion had only happened in Britain, because it's an island, so it's a bridgehead and you can fortify it. And so I just thought, industrious Victorians, how come? And it just seemed like a natural. So, but it took about 20 odd years, plus to actually get it to see print.
And then, ironically, you got commissioned to do an adaptation of the original novel that it was a sequel to.
That's right. It was, again, it was kind of like a nothing's ever uncomplicated with us. The Steven Spielberg film was due to come out, and I think Dark Horse were in negotiation with Jeff Wayne with regards to the rights, because I think the rights are different in the UK and the US, but, you know, public domain and who owns what.
I thought you were going to say the characters were going to break into song for a minute there.
So I think initially Jeff Wayne wanted Dark Horse to do a version based on his
concept album, using the designs, I think actually created by Mike Trim, yeah, for the concept album artwork. Mike Trim is actually a painter and a designer who worked on a lot of the Gerry Anderson stuff in the 1960s, things like Thunderbirds and stuff like that. And he designed Martian war machines and various other things. And Jeff Wayne's idea was to come to Dark Horse, and having seen that we'd done Scarlet Traces, get us to do basically a comics adaptation of the concept album. He was asking really too much money for that, and negotiations kind of fell through. And eventually, after a very kind of long-winded process, he didn't actually find anybody who could take on this project, and time was running out. So he came back to Dark Horse, and they struck a deal where essentially Dark Horse paid him to leave us alone, and we did our version of War of the Worlds. From my point of view, there were two great advantages to this. One is that we could go back. I mean, Jeff Wayne's version is actually reasonably close to the novel, but we were actually able to go back right to the source material. We were able to use my designs for the Martian machines, which actually conform slightly more closely to the book, and so there would have been certain passages in the book, if we tried to transcribe them with the Jeff Wayne version, where it would have been awkward to do. I would have to build things on to the Jeff Wayne designs.
Well, and reconcile Scarlet Traces with the, you know...
This is the thing, we might have had to let that go, whereas one of the things we kind of snuck into our adaptation is, where it was appropriate, and only where it was appropriate, characters who will later appear in Scarlet Traces appear in War of the Worlds, which means that our version of the War of the Worlds will stand on its own completely. If you've never seen any of our stuff and you've just read the novel, or if you've never read anything, you can read that book and you get a flavour of what Wells wrote. But at the same time, it's also Scarlet Traces Zero. And if you've read Scarlet Traces, you will recognise characters. If you read Scarlet Traces and go back, you'll suddenly go, oh god, that guy on the deck of the steamer there becomes really important later on and stuff like that. So it was nice to be able to drop that in and kind of create this integration across three books.
And when it came to doing the adaptation, how much did you say, this has got to be faithful to Wells, and then this has got to appeal to the fans who have bought the Scarlet Traces?
The initial thing was, we only had, for the adaptation, like 60 comic pages. Right. It broke down to more for screen pages, because Dark Horse ran it online initially. And so it was a matter of like having to trim down the novel to fit into 60 pages. And there is part of Wells' novel which it does... dramatically veer off on a tangent.
Yeah.
It goes like, meanwhile, while I was doing this, my brother was in London doing this. And then you have like another like third of the book, which is the brother's adventure, and you just can't, you know, you can't drop the story in midstream and do that. So what I had to do was attribute certain kind of what was happening in London to the curate. And although we actually don't hear the brother speak, I think we actually do see the revelations of what's happening in London. It's the brother in the panels and the two women who he meets. I think so. People who know the book will actually go, oh right, okay. You know, they've had to truncate that, but I recognise that guy and those two people. And also as well, because we did have to trim things out quite dramatically and concertina stuff, I tried to keep in more like little accents. So there's a scene where you see the narrator mentions there are a couple running away, fleeing from the Martians, but between them they're carrying a door, and on the back of the door are all these potted orchids. So we put that in, and then there'll be a bit where he sees a fishmonger's lorry or something tipped over, and he mentions the name, so we put that in. So it's all kind of like little tips of the hat, so that people who have read the novel go, oh yes, yeah, they did that. So it's kind of, they go, yeah, you know, we have trying to be as honest to the source material as we can within reason for the 60 pages.
I mean, in a way, that's almost like doing a Hollywood adaptation, you know, where you're paring it down, making it sort of more visual for less literate audiences, but at the same time trying to keep the fans of the original happy.
Definitely. I mean, there are a couple of instances where there's a scene where the narrator reaches Marble Arch, the hundreds of people had been killed by the Martian black smoke, like germ warfare, you know, gas warfare. Yeah, yeah. And so we had it where Marble Arch and a rough disc surrounding it is just thick with kind of like a black dust. And they were kind of like the semi, almost like the bodies from Pompeii, sort of smothered in the black dust. And he walks through the dust, leaving white footprints as it disturbs it. And as he steps out the other side, he leaves a trail of black footprints. And it kind of makes a really nice, you know, jarring visual image. And another where he actually goes to the main Martian earthwork. And he's walking, the Martians are dead, but he's walking through a forest of war machines and looks up at the sky, and the tentacles are dangling down. There's a clear blue sky above him. And again, that's very like a cinematic, photographic moment. So we just kind of put that in, just kind of, you know, raise the game a little bit.
In a way, it's like you've collaborated with another writer on that project. You did the same when you did X-Force for Marvel. I thought your reinvention of that comic and the other two that came out, Brian Woods and...
Stephen Grant.
The Counter X-Books. I think it's a part of X-Men history that's really good and seems to be completely forgotten by the fans.
Yeah, I think it was... Politically, it was a strange period in Marvel's history because it was just before the big handover, when there was a big shake-up came. So it was kind of like, I suppose, the last bits of a dying regime kind of thing. And the Counter X-Books basically were kind of... initially set up by Warren Ellis. He kind of like came up with the overall concepts for each three book and then the plots for the first four issues of each three books, and then you meant to carry on in the spirit from there. But unfortunately, after the first four issues, when I came to carry on following like Warren's layouts, they said, oh no, you can't use that character, you can't use that scenario. And it's like, but it's just been approved. They go, oh, no, you can't do that. And it's like, but you know, where do we go with it? Because there was nothing else laid out. So in essence, then you're kind of having to pick up the ball and run with it and also like write the thing on the fly. And that was kind of like slightly hairy, writing an X book. Because writing an X book initially it's a great privilege, kind of, you know, to actually be offered an X title. But then suddenly like to be dropped in the deep end and go, well, you know, the game plan you had, that's all scrapped. There you go, off you go. You know, we don't know what you're going to do, it's up to you. And so you're going, oh. So you're kind of like running scared. And I'm quite pleased with the way it turned out. But again, I think we felt like all three of the Counter-X books fell prey to the politics at the time, and you know, it was fun. But I think it's put me off wanting to do spandex. Right. Kind of like I've done that. I mean, I am doing some more superhero stuff now, but it's just kind of I thought, you know, I don't want to kind of do that again. And that's how come, you know, doing the stuff with Matt. This is what I like to do now. You know, it's kind of I've found my niche, and that's what I like to do.
So I was going to ask, was it an enjoyable experience working on the Fox Monsters, Aliens and Predator?
Yeah, actually, that was quite fun. I mean, again, the only thing you have to recognise is that whatever you do, Fox own it. So whatever ideas you may come up with. But to be honest, I don't mind that. And they're great toys to play with, basically. So it's kind of, you know, they take, basically, with the Alien, all it just does is, like, you know, kill people, reproduce. Is that, you know, you can't give it any kind of other added depth that Predators may be. And so, you know, in essence, it's just, like, the greatest toys to play with. You know, and building the story around them kind of thing. So it's more about the people that they kind of prey on and interact with than as opposed to, you know, the creatures themselves.
Matt, you've also worked with Warren Ellis on Lazarus Churchyard. That seems to be very much a sort of seminal work for him and sort of set up themes that would reoccur throughout his career. I mean, presumably it was one of the first things that you did.
Yeah, I think Lazarus Churchyard represented a kind of a transition for both of us. I mean, for Warren, I think it was the first professional work of any length that he had as a comics writer. Before then, he'd been intensively involved in comics journalism. For me, it was a kind of step up because it represented a shift from essentially sort of working in the kind of hinterland of comics where you were kind of just about scraping a page rate and actually doing work which was very enjoyable. But, I mean, I was working for Deadline and I'd also worked on a comic called Mr. X. And, like, the combination of the two was just about paying the bills, but the sales were very small and the stuff was, in a lot of ways, not really getting noticed. Moving to Lazarus Churchyard was a chance to start working in colour. And looking back now, it was also a fantastic opportunity to play with all these kind of fun futuristic concepts, which had not, I mean, I think it existed in science fiction for quite a while, literary science fiction, but they hadn't really percolated through to comics yet. And one of the things I'm quite proud of is how much of Lazarus Churchyard survived in Transmetropolitan. There is a kind of lost Lazarus Churchyard book called Fury Eyes, which, just to explain very briefly, Lazarus Churchyard started as six-page episodes in a monthly magazine called Blast. Blast folded after about seven or eight issues. And Lazarus Churchyard was picked up by an outfit called Tundra UK, who were the people who published Kingdom of the Wicked as well, who produced it as a series of collections about, I think, 30 or 40 pages long. Now, one of the problems with that is that we basically at that point got two full collections worth of material. But Warren's next big idea was going to be a thing called Fury Eyes, which was going to take Lazarus to America and have him look at the American presidential elections in the future. And in a regular monthly comic, this would have taken more than a year's worth of continuity. It was going to be something like 90 pages long, so maybe 18 months' worth of storytelling. With the publishing them as collections, he couldn't really have more than sort of 48 pages. And I had at one point a draft script for Fury Eyes where he tried to squeeze this thing down into the space and it just wouldn't fit. And we gave up on that and instead did a kind of more shoot-em-up adventure called Inspector Sleep as the third Lazarus Churchyard story. Fury Eyes kind of obviously percolated in the back of Warren's head and eventually becomes the presidential election story in Transmetropolitan. And an awful lot of ideas from Fury Eyes, which include the Hell's Angels and the revivified sleepers, all appeared first in Lazarus Churchyard. And in fact, the notion of kind of apartment blocks which have these devices which will reconstitute matter into any shape that you want. I think base block devices, they call in Transmetropolitan, was originally an idea that I fed through to Warren, having heard it on a technology program on Radio 4 while I was working one day. It'd be cool to put that in. So it's like Transmetropolitan to me feels kind of rather like Warren's sort of bastard offspring. And it's very interesting when I read Warren's later work to see how much of his ideas of the world were already formed when we were doing Lazarus Churchyard. It's also meant that for me, Lazarus Churchyard has been a disproportionately sort of well-recognised early work, because as Warren Ellis's first published project, it got back into print disproportionately easily, and a very large number of people are interested in owning it because people like to collect all of Warren's stuff. So it was a thing that bought me my first laptop, and for that I'm kind of always grateful to Warren, basically.
The thing what Matt was saying about pacing, looking at that being decompressed or whatever into 40 pages, your projects together have been reprinted in these sort of lovely European style hardbacks. When you're doing a strip that's initially serialized, do you think of the ultimate end product as being, you know, a bookshelf product?
A few years ago, probably not. But these days, I think the secondary kind of trade paperback collection market is paramount. You know, you have to think, you know, it's going to look, you know, good on the bookshelf. Comic shops seem to be kind of in short supply these days. So actually being able to pick up the issues, and especially in the UK, the back issue market seems to be kind of contracting, that everybody's looking to trades for, you know, that's the future. And so actually, the single issues, you know, the single issue comic, you know, monthly comic, almost like facilitates the trades. I do believe I heard somewhere that for the first time Marvel is actually making more money on trade paperback sales than it is, the comics are a loss leader for the trade paperbacks. So yeah, I think you do have to look at the bookstore market for your work.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. If you look at a lot of Marvel comics, they read very much like a sixth of a graphic novel rather than an individual issue. But for example, your stuff, it seems to come from a more literary background. So is it more like writing a chapter of a serialized novel in the tradition of sort of like, you know, Dickens and Conan Doyle?
I'm going to say yes, because it feeds my ego. It's all done deliberately. A lot of it is on the fly, and so you know, not trying to, you know, brag, but I write it on the fly, and it's only when I look back and go, oh, actually, you know, that's not too bad. That works out, and you know, there's a bit of nipping and tucking and tweaking and kind of to fit it all in. But yeah, it is kind of, it is in that tradition to a certain degree, because I like that kind of fiction, that kind of atmosphere and environment. So it's kind of, yeah. So I'd have to say yes.
And then at the same time, you've both worked on Judge Dredd, which is presumably telling a whole story in 8 pages, which must be quite a lot of pressure.
I think Matt says it's like, was it angels dancing on the head of a pin?
Waltzing inside a matchbox is how I think of it.
And again, a little like Aliens versus Predator, Dredd really is kind of secondary to the kind of the character that we've written the story about, which again it feeds into our like Victorian, you know, kind of Tim Burton kind of feel, in that it's a kind of a poor Victorian time traveller who arrives in Mega City 1, has his time machine stripped and put up on bricks, he's like stripped down to his underwear, he's about to be organ robbed, and then Dredd arrests him for like indecent exposure, and so it's just, you know, the iniquities of the law railed against this poor man. And so in essence, you know, really it's just like we're just using Dredd to bounce off to show how mad this world is through the eyes of this poor idealist. And so far we've had three stories. It's kind of a sneaky plan. We're trying to build up so we have enough stories about this protagonist and his future selves, the Gang of Four, that they can't either get their own strip or they get their own trade paperback collection at some point.
I was going to say, because it feels like you've given a happy ending, but presumably there are more stories to come.
Well, we'd like to. We are trying to like sneak in some more stories now, because they've decided to stay in Mega City 1.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, what are they going to do next? So we've got to sit down and work out what they do. And I think yeah, if Matt Smith, who's 2080 editor, if he's amenable, we'll do a small mini-series or something regarding these guys, because they're just too good to get rid of yet, I think.
Or are you building up to being asked to do an adaptation of The Time Machine by H.G. Wells as the prequel?
You know, that would be... We'll just work our way through the Wells canon.
Matt, looking at your work, technology seems to facilitate it a lot as you've become increasingly just working in the digital world. I mean, as comics become more reliant on technology, do you find yourself trying to think in terms of old-fashioned art but using, you know, modern technology?
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, I have always thought that way, and however baroque-looking my artwork may get, the thought process I use to create it is very much analogous to, you know, drawing things out roughly, drawing them in pencil, inking them in or painting them, whatever. If you actually see the working stages, it looks very similar to the, you know, if you actually took a drawing on paper and photocopied it at each stage of the production. I joke that during my... sort of 10 odd years as a graphic artist working on paper, that I spent the whole of that time trying to wrestle with real media and make them look as flawless and seamless as possible. And then I've transferred to the digital world, and I've spent the last 10 years trying to make the flawless digital world look as distressed and organic as possible. One of the things that surprised me, actually, when some stuff of old stuff of mine went into reprint a couple of years ago, was looking back and seeing actually how much technology I was using, even in the old days. I mean, going back to Lazarus Churchyard, there's a lot of stuff in there which involved making artwork, processing it using special effects settings on colour laser copiers, which were like the big new technology of the time, and then physically collaging everything together afterwards. The main thing about using technology is remembering always what your actual purpose is, that whatever you use to make it, when you're drawing comic art, the point of it, oh dearie me, yes, is to tell a story, and anything that actually hinders that or does not serve it needs to be cut away and dropped. So although at the moment I'm kind of dancing with chaos in terms of for the latest work we've done for 2000 AD called Stickleback, using a lot of kind of pseudo-painted effects and using a lot of textures and so on, at the end of the day, what I'm actually still looking for after the initial visual surprise is clarity and a sort of clear path of storytelling, so that you not only look at this thing and go, wow, you can actually read it and make sense of it.
Which kind of leads on to my last question. What should we expect from you guys next? More Stickleback, presumably, and...
Yeah, Stickleback basically is my kind of nod to the comics I read when I was younger, you know, Lion and Valiant. But primarily there was a character called the Spider, which I always really struck me because he was about the villain. The hero was a villain. And so I thought, well, let's do something like that. And also because we'd done Leviathan, which was kind of a self-contained story for Rebellion. We'd done a couple of short stories, and then there was nowhere else really we could go with it. And we wanted to have a kind of a character we could bring back of our own. So we basically came up with Stickleback, and he's kind of like pseudo Tim Burton-y, you know, gothic Victorian London. And he's the Pope of Crime. And he's called so-called Stickleback because he has born with a secondary rib cage growing out of his back, and the ribs are all snapped like the little stickleback fish. And he has his group of strange, freakish cohorts who kind of vie for the criminal underworld, and actually at the end of the series end up like running London. And then we've got just about to start on the second series now, which has an evil Wild West show. So that should start running at Christmas, and then hopefully I think Rebellion plan to collect both series in a nice hardcover sometime in the spring. But as the story's gone on, we've kind of decided that Stickleback isn't just a by-the-numbers villain. We have the hint that maybe he's, you know, the deformity is makeup. Or is he somebody else? At one point, a character goes, you know, I know who you are. And, you know, and Stickleback kind of blanches. So we've kind of a mystery wrapped in enigma kind of thing. So this, we've left ourselves like lots of plot threads kind of thing to play with over the years.
So more Stickleback to look forward to, and hopefully an uber hardback of the Scarlet Traces trilogy at some point.
Hopefully. Dark Horse are doing their Dark Horse Presents anthology online, and they came to us and asked for, do we have any short fiction? Mm. And people have asked, is there any more to Scarlet Traces? And I think it's kind of run its course, but the one thing I'd like to do is maybe an 8 or 10 page story where you find out what happens to Robert Autumn, who's the protagonist from Scarlet Traces and The Great Game, because he's such a great old cove. And, you know, I'd like the 8 pages where at the end we see him in the ground. Kind of, that's it, that's the end of it. But just to give him like a nice hero's send-off, kind of, a nice little a nod and a tear in the eye, you know, and that's the end of that kind of thing. So, you know, it's done. We can walk away from it. I don't believe, you know, in going back to things sometimes. You know, that's the end of it. So, there you go.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On next week's show, you'll hear my interview with Gary Russell, script editor of Doctor who has just started writing a monthly American comic book based on the TV series, and previously wrote a weekly strip about the Time Lord's adventures in the Radio Times. If you'd like to know more about tonight's show and download podcasts, please visit www.panelborders.com, and we'll be back at the same time next week.